Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's July 4th, 2021, and welcome to episode 238 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to Oz?
Yours Here is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, school, and forth. I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts today. First is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Bingo card check.
Excellent. Also joining us today is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How does that compare to fantastic?
It's worse. I'm winning. Let's just be clear.
The winner so far.
All right. And also joining us from Los Angeles is Quinn Dunkey. How are you?
I would say I'm somewhere in between Carrington and Earl there. So I'm doing pretty fantastic. Let's say that.
What about you, Paul?
All right. So I guess I have to round off my, I have to come in at the bottom of the scale. Everything's terrible. It's not actually, but... Okay, so we have, the last couple times we've been talking about sort of like the beginning, either our experiences with computers entering schools or our experiences in schools with computers, things of that nature. Earl has not yet been here when we've talked about that, so and I hear he has notes. So maybe we'll start off with Earl talking about that, and then we can all chip in.
Earl's prepared for a pop quiz.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I'm ready for that, but computers in school, yeah, that was a big deal for me. So the summer before I started in the ninth grade, I saw my friend Paul messing with some punch cards. I was like, what are you doing? And he said, hey, don't you know we have a computer science course in at our junior high, which today you'd call middle school. And so I said, no, I didn't know that. And how am I not in that? So the second the term started, I marched into my counselor's office and said, please, please put me in the class now, which he did. And that was really awesome. I had been playing around with digital electronics before that, like TTL chips and 7-segment displays and stuff like that. But wow, this was an actual computer. So I was super jazzed. The main thing that we did, though, wasn't really in a lab at the middle school. It was that we sent in Fortran programs on either punched cards or something called a Mark Sense card that looked like a punch card. It was the same size, except you didn't punch holes in it. You used a number 2 pencil to mark the Hollerith codes on it as if it had gone through a key punch, which, as you can imagine, was pretty tedious. But it's what we had. So that's what we did. We'd send in our Mark Sense cards, and in a extremely timely 2-day turnaround, we would get our programs back, which we would then have to debug and send again. So it was a pretty slow wash, rinse, repeat cycle. I have a vague memory of us also having a key punch machine in the middle school lab, but we didn't use it much. It was reserved for doing the special cards, like the cards that would start and end your card deck. We couldn't just sit at the key punch and plug away at our whole programs because that was seen as a waste. So anyway, we didn't use that much. A month or two into the term, as I recall, my instructor brought in an Apple II computer. This was the original Apple II model. And I actually think it was his own computer that he brought in to let us pound on, which was just unbelievably generous. He really had a heart to teach us about computing, and we learned a lot. I programmed a computer game on there called Torpedo, as I recall, where you take the paddles and try to sink the ship, which the ship was just a pixel. You had to use your imagination. It was one of the low-res Apple II programs, but that was fun.
Weirdly, it looked like an adventurer on Atari.
Yeah, exactly. I would have had cool, cover art for that, and then you would have been really disappointed when you played the game. So the Apple II, obviously, that was a game changer for me. But one of the most fun things I remember in the lab was our desktop programmable calculator. So not a handheld, one of the full desktop models. It had the cool NixieTube displays, which to this day, I just absolutely love. Those things are awesome. They look like something that you'd expect to see in a 60s sci-fi. And this programmable calculator had a paper reader. It could read programs that, again, you bubbled in with a number two pencil, but you used, instead of things that look like punch cards, hard stock like that, it was a paper that looked kind of like a Scantron. You guys remember Scantrons?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe you have bad memories of Scantrons from things like tests.
Yeah, we took a lot of tests on those.
But these were good memories on this programmable calculator. We made our own games for that, like things like guess the random number and stuff like that. So that was super fun. So I have really good memories about the middle school computing. And I think, this was, think back on the year, this was 78. So we were, I think, kind of a little bit ahead of the curve at this particular school, having all that equipment to use. Mm-hmm. And then high school, that was kind of a level up. The first thing that we had, well, I guess maybe this first thing I'm going to talk about wasn't exactly a level up. It was a teletype model ASR33, the chung, 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 chung. And it had a three, I have to draw a word picture for those. Can't imagine an ASR33 in your mind. Man, that thing was noisy. It had a 300 baud dial-up acoustic modem that we would use to connect to the school mini computer. And I'm not sure what the computer was that we were connecting to, but based on the basic dialect that it had, I think it was a DEC mini computer. Anyway, that's what I'm guessing. And that was actually pretty popular in school, so I think I'm right on that. Also, in terms of microcomputers, we had a TRS-80 Model 1, with level 2 basic and the expansion unit and dual disk drives. That was the super popular computer for people doing their work. And so it was really hard to basically to negotiate for time on that computer. You had to take your turn. But that's the system that I used for my first programming job. I might have talked about that on the podcast before. There was a company that came to my instructor and said, hey, you have anybody who might want to write us some custom software? Because we have a company that services key punch machines. People will have like maybe 5 key punch machines on their premises. They'll buy a warranty for one, and then they'll have us servicing all 5. And we don't have any way to keep track of which ones we have the warranty on and which ones we don't. So a friend of mine, Arthur, and I wrote them a database to help them keep track so that they wouldn't lose money on their warranties. So that was pretty fun. We got paid a little bit of money, and, I was in heaven. I was like, I'm programming for money. Oh, that was so cool. But the other thing that we had in that lab was a Commodore PET 2001. And so, this is trying to figure out how old it would have been at that point. Doesn't matter. People didn't want to use it because of the funky keyboard. This was the one with the chiclet keyboard and the cassette reader built in. So people were like, I don't want to try and type on that thing. But to me, it's like, this is a computer. I can get time on it. I'm not having to check anybody into the boards to, kind of jostle for some time on this system. So I dug into it, and that's actually what got me started down the road with Commodore. So then university. And this was really an interesting change because so far in both middle school and high school, there was access to microcomputers in the lab. But strangely, at university, there wasn't. It was just a room full of terminals, mostly DEC VT style terminals. But there were one or two ones there that were kind of weird. And that's where we did our coursework. And one of the most interesting things that I remember about that lab doesn't have anything to do with technology. There were some trees around that lab that smelled like eucalyptus. And whenever you'd go to the computer lab, it smelled so nice coming in and out. And in the computer lab itself, as you can imagine, with a bunch of students that have been there for hours and all those warm terminals, inside the lab didn't smell as great as outside the lab. But whenever I smell eucalyptus just walking around these days, I think of the computer lab from university, which is a really weird memory association, but I'm going to go with it. So on those terminals, we did most of our work on the DEC PDP-11 and on the cyber system that was actually on campus. But via networking, we could get to some other weird systems. I don't remember much about them, didn't have to use them much for my courses. All I remember is that a lot of those other systems were frequently down. Like when you came in the computer lab, there was this giant sign on one of the walls that told you which of the computers were operational and which ones were having trouble. And these funky ones that were off campus seemed to constantly be having issues. I don't know what was up with that, but it didn't matter because I didn't need them. I did most of the stuff on the DEC computer, and that's kind of how I developed a fond place in my heart for Digital Equipment Corp systems. Now, it was fun going to the computer lab, and it was kind of a communal experience, but it was also crowded, and especially when you started to get toward finals week, it was difficult to get time again on the computers, again with the competing for time. So I had this bright idea. I got a VIC-20, and I got the 40-column, I think it was called VicTerm program that you could use with it, with a modem, and I was actually able to remote into the university computer, which my friends thought was awesome cool. I got serious geek cred for having a system at home.
For your VIC-20.
Terminals, so wasn't great, but for whatever crazy reason, terminals of that day, the 80-column terminals, were really expensive. I imagine, I remember looking at the prices of the terminals and looking at how I could outfit the VIC-20 to do it, and it was kind of a no-brainer. The one set of terminals that they had in the lab at university, though, that were awesome were the DeckWriter standing printing terminals. Do you guys know what I mean about those? They sit up kind of on their own stand, and they have a big, wide keyboard, and they're 132-column paper that goes through there, and they're dot matrix as opposed to some other kind of technology. Those just had the greatest sound. Whenever I needed a printout of my program that I could turn in, rather than trying to go through the help desk, I would try and just jockey for some time on one of the deck writers and print it out on there. So thought those were awesome. And it's one of the last things actually I'd probably still like to add to my computer collection. So I just remember those very fondly. So that was my experience with labs. And I don't know what I would have done if it wasn't for the time, lab time in those various environments, because I didn't have a computer at home and I wasn't likely to afford a computer at home until later in my career when I could actually get a full-time job and save up for one. So that was my deal. I have lots of super fond memories about those days in all three of those environments.
It's interesting you mentioned the cost of the terminals. I thought about that a while back as well. So in university, for me, was 1994, and the first years and maybe second year computer science students were also still on VT100 terminals, which seems surprising that late. You know, in high school, we had PCs, but then we got into university, and it was almost like a downgrade to these terminals. And my theory on that is that because they were like an enterprise solution, right? And so just like everything enterprise, it was you know, incredibly overpriced and probably came with some giant service contract and everything else. And so the school was probably locked into these things and needed to get their money's worth out of them. So they kept those things like way into the 90s. It wasn't until a third or fourth year we got, they also had a lab with Sun workstations in it. And so we got to work on those. But yeah, we got a lot of time on the VT-100s.
Well, they might have been also like an early adopter too, right? I mean, like that yeah. The university may have gotten there sooner and so got outfitted their labs and then didn't have the ability to do it again.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Do you remember what you were connecting to with the VTs?
We never knew, honestly. I suppose I could have asked the IT guy, the head of IT, who was actually a friend of mine towards the end of my time there. But funnily enough, I never actually asked, so I don't know what they were. I suspect, I'm not even going to guess. I don't know. One of my professors, our assembly language professor, had a PDP 11, I want to say, in his office that he was very proud of. He had it on display, and whenever you had office hours with him, you'd get to sit next to this thing. And I think that may have previously belonged to the school. So, and he just, they were going to throw it out or whatever, and he claimed it. So I think, you know, it was some sort of migration from that, but it was BSD Unix, I think. So whatever would have run that, I'm not sure.
Yeah, the computer that we connected to in college was a VAX. So, you know, I have a sort of a similar fondness for whatever that is, 1991 era VAX machines. So we had the wall of orange manuals, and you know, I knew a little bit about how to sort of work my way around. What is it? VMS?
VMS.
Is I think, yeah, VMS is the VAX one, and MVS is the whatever you use in SimH.
The IBM one.
Yeah.
Did anybody else use Sun micro? What do they call them? Micro stations or Sun workstations at any point? Those are really nice machines. I really enjoyed those. We had it. One of our assembly language classes, 68,000, was on that. Was on those machines, and they had really nice displays on them. And they had the optical mice. They had the special mouse pad. I don't know if you've ever seen these. They had a reflective grid on them that had to be under the mouse. And if you turned them 90 degrees, they wouldn't work. So a common prank was to go around and turn all the mouse pads 90 degrees, of course, and then none of the mice worked. The other fun prank was that the networking on that was 10Base2, that thin coax networking that with the little T junctions between all the machines. And they had to have so it was a ring that ran around the room, and then there was a terminator at the end. And if you took the terminator off, all the networking died. So, of course, that was something everyone did. They were really nice machines, though, aside from all that.
Nice machines, mean peers.
I never used one of the 68K Suns. Jealous about that.
Yeah, they were neat.
Yeah, the ones I used were, by the time I got into Sun, they were running the Spark chips.
Yeah. Yeah, and these had no disk in them. They were full netboot. And so, they booted fully off the network and everything. So it was a full graphical X Windows workstation, but no disk in it at all. So it was pretty cool. It was kind of like the purest dream of X Windows that they had early on before everyone realized what a terrible idea all those things were.
It was interesting. One thing, Earl, that you mentioned, you know, somewhere in the middle was that you got hired as a kid to write software, and that happened to me too. And I was I think this was eighth grade or something like that. And of course, that's delightful when you're a kid. You're like, oh, yeah. This is much better than any paperwork delivery job. But
it just seems so cool. Yeah,
I'm sure from their perspective, it's also great because they don't know how to do it and they don't have to pay you practically anything.
Oh, they totally got us on the cheap.
Yeah.
I think my take on that was $70 and we put so many hours into that thing. But that was okay, though, because we were having fun.
Mm-hmm. That was my first programming job, too. I wrote a client management system for a massage therapist in the area. And yeah, I must have spent 1,000 hours on that thing, and I think he paid me $200 or something, which I had no idea how much my time was worth, and I thought that was fine.
Yeah, I did a salon management thing. So apparently, this is cool. That's the industry for exploitation of local programming labor.
Yeah. We've talked about this before, but niche small business software is a racket. Like, it's all hyper vertically integrated with these obscure applications that nobody outside of that business has heard of, and custom proprietary file formats for everything so that you're locked into their terrible ecosystems. It's, yeah, like dentist office, veterinary offices, all their software is terrible. Like, next time you're at your optometrist or your dentist, like, take a look at their screen that the doctor is using, and you'll see some terrible, like, Windows 2000 thing with this terrible piece of software on it that he's been using for 10 years. Yeah, it's a racket. They're terrible.
Right. Everything running in a, like, an emulated machine because they, you know.
Emulating an emulator. Yeah, I did the same, similar things for Corrugate converters. Box makers take cardboard, basically. Same thing. It's all weird vertical stuff that's not used anywhere else. And I got known as a guy could come in and like work with those stupid things. So all the box makers, it's terrible. And finally, I'm like, no, I'm not doing any more box software. Upgrade. I don't care if your whole industry dies. It's terrible. Oh, yeah, I did that for a few years. I hated every minute of it.
We had some software that was similar in the chemical manufacturing realm. It was just, again, one of these niche applications that it looked like it was 20 years old. And it really, I mean, the interface was, it just made you want to scream. Tiny little non-changeable fonts, you know, fixed window sizes on Windows. You couldn't like resize anything. So you were just kind of stuck with the screen that they gave you. Oh my gosh, no good.
I will admit I did that for a client once who I really didn't like, and I made software with a fixed window size, but the internal viewport was slightly larger than that, so there was always a scroll bar that could only move a tiny bit, and I just knew it would trigger him like crazy. I'm like, sorry, that's just how it comes. I don't know what to do about that. Such is my petty vengeance.
Well, for only a, you know, twice as much, I can build you one that has those extra pixels.
I'm just suffering from RSI now from scrolling back and forth.
That's all right. I got my own petty vengeance, although accidentally the software that I wrote for that massage therapist was absolutely terrible. It was so buggy, and it had like 15 different bugs that would corrupt all the files periodically. And so he re-entered all this data like 6 times, and just not intentionally, but just because I didn't know what I was doing and I had no idea how to write software on that scale. And it was one of the worst things I've ever written. And so I'm sure he didn't ever end up using it in any kind of long term, but so it all came out in the end.
It's pretty rough working with people who don't really understand what you're doing too, because a little later on when I did actually know a little bit more about what I was doing, it doesn't really matter. It was like an inventory program for a food company, but I was always sort of like, it was always a bit of a battle. They're like, you know, we don't want to spend very much money doing this. So, you know, even though you're telling me that I'm going to really want this feature, I'm not going to pay for it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, but you're going to be very unhappy.
Yes. Yeah. And those small business owners, like, they're not technically savvy necessarily, especially like in the early 90s when people are trying to computerize. And so they think that buying a piece of software like this or paying you to write it is going to be like buying a toaster. They're just going to get it and it's going to have features and it's just going to work forever. But it's like, no, software is, there's maintenance and it takes a while to get, you know, bugs fixed, and you have to update things. And, you know, people didn't yet understand what it's like to live with software. People thought of it as, you know, a thing that they just acquired and it would solve the problem forever.
One thing that I did in my Clipper consulting years, it was kind of interesting. The approach that I would take is small companies would come and say, I need this and this and this. I'd say, okay, so let's get you a pilot program that does some of this, and it'll be for a fixed price. And then afterwards, if you want more functionality, you want to do other things with it, then we'll renegotiate. And that worked out pretty well. This one company, the trailer company, they did this with me, and they said, okay, let's do the first part. The other thing that I said was, if you don't like it, you don't have to pay for it. You have to...
Earl and I took very different approaches.
Well, I wanted to be able to generate, you know, a stream of word of mouth kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So some references. So this trailer company bought software from me to do their thing, and I never heard from them again. And I thought, okay, they paid me. They must not have liked it, but they didn't want their money back. They just went another way. This was, I don't know, early 90s, I think way early 90s. So then actually around the year 2000, a friend of mine who had hooked me up with them contacted me and said, hey, are you still doing development? And I said, well, I haven't been doing that kind of development for a while. Why? And he said, well, this trailer company is still using your software, but they want to know whether or not it's Y2K compliant. I was like, holy cow, they're still using that software after this many years? I'm amazed. They say, yeah, they love the software. They're still using it. And I was like, well, I apologize that I can't help them on the Y2K because I'm totally not into that anymore. But that was kind of a pleasant surprise. I found out it not only had it been in use, but, got a lot of mileage for them.
I think that's unusual for a piece of software. That's a nice result, actually. I went the other way. I mean, I went back to freelance software development in the 2010, around 2011. I was doing app development, and I just charged hourly. It's like all, because by now it's like in the world of changing requirements constantly and needing to migrate to new OS versions, and, software is just this constant churn. And so I'll do whatever you want, and here's my hourly rate. And that honestly turned out to be great because then customers were free to make whatever changes they want. We want this menu over there and we want this background or whatever. It's like, yeah, hey, great, I'll do whatever you want, because it's not cutting into my bottom line because I gave them some kind of fixed estimate. And then, the constant migration to keep their software working, the cost of that is covered. Like iOS 7 paid my mortgage for like 2 months because I had all these customers. iOS 7, they changed a bunch of fundamental things about how window layout works. And so everybody's apps broke. So I got paid to go over and fix all my clients' apps again. It was great.
Yeah, you're right. Things are a way different deal these days than they were back then. I mean, you could actually write a program back then that could get used for 5, 6, 7 years on. But one of the things that people did back then pretty frequently was, rather than get somebody to rewrite it to make it faster, they would just get a faster machine to run it on. It was actually cheaper to go from like a 286 to a 386 or a 386 to 486 than it would be to try to make the software more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad did that with his veterinary business. He was running the original DOS, terrible vertical software that like we were talking about. And I mean, he was running it on like a Pentium 3 or something at one point, but it was the original DOS program that he'd purchased in 1991 or something. But it was basically impossible to migrate his data out of this terrible piece of software. So he just kept upgrading the computer to make it faster and putting bigger hard drives in and things like that. But it was still this terrible piece of software.
Yeah, I seem to remember this came up a couple times ago. Like it was maybe something that would unzip or like unstuff a Mac file. But the way it actually did this was it spun up an entire Mac emulator, booted the system, ran stuff it, and unstuffed it. And then it's like, all right, yeah. It just seemed like there must have been a more efficient way to do this, but not time efficient.
Yeah. Something I learned from all of that was, if you're going to write software, just know software very often lasts longer than you think it will.
Not my software.
People drag their feet for some reason or another, and it's just, it's going to stick around.
That's the truth.
Yeah, although I was actually, when you were talking about that, I was thinking, my own experience, more than writing something that I discover later, lots of people, like a person's using long after I'd expected, is writing something that just never quite launched, like that I think is probably a pretty common experience where like it took so long to get through this that they finally went another way, and I had a done, driver or whatever, it was all basically working, but by then it wasn't worth it. So that's a little disappointing because you have the thing, you put your, you put a little bit of your heart into it and it didn't do anything. But
I would say over the course of my career, most of the things I've worked on never saw the light of day. Like that's
same
for me, at least, has been the norm, partly because most of my time was spent in games. But yeah, like for every game that ships, there's like 10 more that are canceled. So, like you say, you just get used to pouring your heart into things and then they never go anywhere. And it's like, well, okay, on to the next one. Mm-hmm.
And I guess in a sort of a team environment, then there's not even anything to show someone later. You know,
yeah.
Like your part worked, and that's not visible to anybody.
Yeah, and it's lost forever too, because like a lot of the games I worked on, for example, on the PlayStation 2, the only record of it that we have was a silver disc, a prototype disc, but those won't boot in a normal PlayStation. So even if you have an old PlayStation 2, you have to have an old PlayStation 2 dev kit that could read the silver discs, the unencrypted discs, because they used a special laser for the commercial discs that couldn't be read with a CD reader. And so these were, you know, CDRs or CDRWs, but you had to have they have a different drive in the dev kits that could read them, and they were in a different format, and the dev kits were leased, so none of those dev kits officially ever made it out into the wild. So you'd have to find an old dev kit that someone didn't return when their lease was up like they were supposed to, and somehow got away with that, and then could read this disc. Like, it's so, as in from an archiving standpoint, you know all these hundreds of thousands of prototype games out there on consoles are just going to be gone forever. I think I actually have the code for it though, so I could probably get it going in an emulator maybe, but not that I was supposed to take the code with me, but
we didn't hear a thing.
Yeah. Nobody's listening to this, right?
All right. It's possible that, is there anything else anyone wanted to talk about with respect to Earl's experience in school?
That launched a pretty fun conversation, though. I'm happy we did that.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess we can move on. There are a couple of, well, there's one feedback thing I'll mention from the feedback, and then I'll leave more feedback for later. This one came in a little while ago, but someone was pointing out that someone had built a Commodore 64 in a Game Boy form factor. I don't know have people seen this?
I haven't seen this.
No.
So it's it's fairly beautiful. You know, it's a sort of Game Boy shaped thing. It has a little D-pad on it and a full keyboard,
of course,
very small keys, but. And, you know, so it's basically on Hackaday, there's a little write-up of it. So it's not sold as a completed thing, but there are, you can buy the pieces. So if you wanted to make one yourself, you can buy the PCBs for it. It doesn't cost very much. It's, say, 30 euros for the thing without the cover that you put together. And then you can buy for another 10 euros the several different color covers to put it in. And I think the person who's doing this is Matthias, who's creating a new C64 universe you can be a part of. And he's got a Patreon thing sort of covering the development of this. But
does it say, is it using original chips or is it FPGA? Or how?
I think the default actually is to use original chips, but there is a way to do it without sort of cannibalizing existing Commodores. There's a link here to how you can build one without Commodore parts. So
cool.
Where does that link go? Let us see. Oh, I guess it's maybe part of this other new Commodore project, Commodore Reloaded MK2.
Well, you know, the Commodore, the chips that are in a C64, many of them have been replicated with modern day replacements.
Right.
That use various techniques, either an ARM chip or a little FPGA or something like that, to replace the functionality. I don't know if they would fit in this form factor, though. They'd have to be an identical size, I guess, because that looks like it's pretty tight in the construction of that unit, not a lot of space to differ from the form factor of the original components.
I really like projects like this. I mean, we've talked about a lot lately about these like fantasy consoles, like the Pico and the Chip 8 and so on, and developing, you know, retro games, but targeting these new niche platforms. I'm much more excited by something like this, where this would be a new modern device that you could have, that you could target retro development to with modern tools and have fun doing that. And when you're done, you've got something that will run on every Commodore 64 in the world and, you know, all these variations of them that people are building. So this is a really cool way to tap into an existing, you know, base of development, but with a modern machine if you want to.
Yeah.
That is a great point. And the other thing that fascinates me about this kind of thing is the industrial design. I'm in awe of individual hobbyists that create things like this. I mean, it's difficult to describe on audio, to paint a word picture of this, but it really is a work of art.
That's beautiful.
And, yeah.
Yeah. And small screens and, you know, lithium ion batteries and so on are so good now that, like, you can have a really beautiful little screen like that. And, you know, you can have 8 hours of battery life in a small space and run something like this now. Like, that's all super cool.
Yeah. And if you are interested in building one yourself, you can get these boards, but they also exist in a couple of other shapes too. So I like this one in particular. This one is if you like your Commodore 64 in a tube shape, you can make a cylinder.
C64. That's really funny.
it's a bunch of discs. The whole thing gets stacked. I would like to see a finished photo. But
yeah, does it say what the diameter is? I really hope it fits in a Pringles can, because that would make me happy.
I suspect it looks to me like it's a little bit bigger than that, but yeah. I don't know. Yeah, that would be pretty great though. Pringles 64.
Exactly. Yes, my dream of a Pringles 64 lives on. That dream I've had for 2.5 seconds.
Right. There's also another version that is basically like a motherboard with a bunch of little cards.
Oh, this is super cool. Modular 64. I love that. It's like a backplane, and all of the little Commodore 64 subsystems are on little, like, SIM-sized plug-in cards. Oh, that's awesome. That's a great idea.
So if you are interested, all this is at uni64.com. Anyway, so that was Bob who wrote in over email to tell us about that. I think I didn't even mention Bob's name, but thank you, Bob. and I think I'll leave that there. We can do more feedback at a different time. So now I guess we can go to items of interest and news. And Carrington has the first of these.
I do indeed. And I found this one because there's a recent article that I found interesting, and it's about... we've talked on this topic a few times about broadcasting software over the internet, over television, over radio, and such. This one struck me as strange, though, because it seemed so incredibly poorly written. And it was only a few minutes ago I realized there was a small link buried in that article to another article from last year, which is essentially the exact same thing. I was taken in by one of those foolish things where people just rebroadcast or republish other people's things and then just have a piece of software change all the adjectives or what have you. So it wasn't just an incredibly poorly written article. It was actually just a total ripoff. So the actual article seems to be coming from Interesting Engineering, actually from last year, but I'd missed it at the time. And this is about software transmitted in BASIC code in the Netherlands over radio in the 1980s. The NOS, which is the Dutch Broadcasting Organization, was the one doing the broadcasting. And so you could hook up your cassette player just to record the audio that was broadcast, and then pump that into your Speccy, and you'd get. Here's an example of Matic Miner that was not broadcast, but you would get free software over the air. This talks about a station in Yugoslavia. It talks about some like interesting things. We've spoken before about how this was a thing in the UK, but this article talks about a couple of other examples from the rest of Europe. So I found it very interesting. So the question I was posing to you when my mic was muted was, were any of you in the Netherlands in the 1980s and have firsthand experience with this? Paul?
As it turns out, no.
I'm just endlessly fascinated by this whole topic, this whole idea that there was a time when this happened, and I kind of wish it still did. Somebody at Kansas Fest should set up a broadcast thing. That might be a fun hack fest, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Once we can do it in real life.
That would be pretty cool. Cool.
Send out...
like a low power FM transmitter.
I used to run a pirate radio station that was, you could hear it probably within 30 feet of my building. It was so low power. I would just imagine my neighbors maybe would tune in, but that's basically all they could listen to me. So we could do the same thing at Kansas Fest maybe. Maybe I'll, a couple years from now, broadcast some software. So I am still remain fascinated by this idea. This topic will never cease to amaze me.
I feel like every couple of weeks we learn about some new game attempt to stream games from 50 years ago or whatever that nobody knew existed. Like there was Atari cartridges over cable, and there was Genesis cartridges over the telephone, and like there was all these services that people kept trying that never went anywhere. And I feel like I keep learning about new ones.
That's it. Also, articles keep getting ripped off and fool me.
Yeah,
you got me again, Internet.
That is a weird phenomenon of computerized synonym plagiarism. I hadn't heard of that before. And that's horrible. Stop doing that.
What about the views, yo?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. All right. My thing, this appeared today, and everybody emailed it to us. So I will talk about it because it is quite interesting. So what it is, this is a Commodore 64 demo. I don't know if you guys saw this in the time that it came in, called Freespin, and it's by Matthias Kram, or Quiss, was I think his demo name. And so this is a YouTube video that sort of shows him running this demo. And if I sort of skip ahead, you can kind of see the kind of thing it's doing. You know, it's running squares, and it's actually playing music at the same time, and it's all fairly impressive. But the thing that is so wild about this is that, in fact, actually what is running this demo is the drive. So this is a Commodore 64 demo that is running after removing the Commodore 64 entirely and connecting the monitor up to the drive.
What? Great.
Yeah. So we know that the Commodore 64 drive has in it a 6502 and can run code of its own. And so what Matthias has done here is basically like connected up the serial output from the drive to the video output with a fancy little cable that it's able to do both video on, video off, and sync signals.
I'm sorry, and by fancy cable you mean he cut apart a composite cable with a pocket knife on camera, twisted the wires together, which is amazing.
And so the way you start it is you open and close the drive, and the drive senses that has happened, and then it just starts running, and it actually, you know, it's typing things, and it's showing, you know, animations and things like that. It's really quite astounding that it is just a drive and a monitor. The Commodore part was just to load it.
Is it loading software from the disk as it goes to do it? Because you're right that the drives have a 6502, but they don't have much RAM,
right?
In the drive. So I can't imagine it doing all this just in the RAM that's built into the 1541. It must somehow be loading in bits from the drive as it goes. I guess I'll have to read about this.
Or it's just maybe just chasing the beam, you know, Atari 2600 style. Even if you only have, you know, a few bytes of RAM, it might be able to do this, just generating it procedurally.
Yeah, well, and I think that is what it's doing. Is it's basically just, you know, it's because there's a description in on his site that sort of talks about, I think you can only operate in blocks of like 32 pixels. That's why everything sort of looks kind of horizontally wide, because that's the time it takes for the chip to sort of like go from on to off, right? Okay. So it is really generating these things on its own.
Wow. But, bananas. Like, there's some great effects in there too. Like, this is not just a stunt. Wow.
It is the best thing
I've seen all year.
Yeah. And actually, if we could, if we had the audio, you would hear that it was actually playing music along with this, you know, and
because of course it is.
Yeah. So, it does actually occasionally read things off the disc though. It's using the disk as a disk drive as well, it is amazing.
Wow, that is fantastic.
I didn't remember, so I just looked it up. It's a 2K of RAM.
That's not bad.
1541.
Okay, yeah. Wow, that's a great effect. Wow, there's so many, like, these are good demo effects too that I would struggle to do on an actual computer.
Yeah.
Never mind the disk drive.
It's very much relying on the fact that everything is sort of like rotating as if horizontal, you know, sort of like a vertical rotation, which is exactly what you can do with this kind of a video signal.
That's the best kind of demo, where it's like they've figured out the parameters of what they can do and then are exploiting the full creative space of those limitations, like what effects you can use to capitalize on your limitations. Which is just the best kind of demo. Wow, this is really astonishing.
Truly remarkable.
So it looks very good, even if you didn't, even if you weren't generating this without a computer. But
you add in that detail, and it's remarkably impressive.
Yeah.
you don't necessarily have to be a Commodore person to appreciate this too, which is nice. Like a lot of scene demos, you have to understand the hardware to understand why it's impressive. You know, because most, like if a modern person looking at a 2GS demo isn't going to be that impressed because it just looks like a bunch of sprites moving around. You have to explain, well, oh no, you see, it's super hard because of this, this, and this, and that's why this is impressive. This, I feel like you don't need that explanation. This is just, it's a disk drive doing some amazing effects.
And actually, there's one thing that I probably should have mentioned, that, but I didn't. I said it was playing sound, but you understand that these don't have speakers, right?
Yeah, so I assume yeah, when it's the playing, drive head, right?
It's the drive playing sound. Yeah, it's by moving itself around.
Yeah.
It's actually, you know, it's making music. It doesn't have any volume control, and they talked a little bit about in the write-up for this, like how different pitches have different volumes, just basically due to resonance of the enclosure and stuff like that. But yeah.
Yeah, that stunt was fairly common back in the day. People would make the disk drives play music on the Commodore by twiddling the drive head around. Yeah. So that part of it was sort of known. But and for people, in case people don't understand, what he's doing is he's bit banging the video over the serial port on the drive. So he's literally just plugged the composite video into the serial port on the drive, and it's just bit banging video out, which is just incredible. Wow.
There is a description on his site that sort of talks about the details of it, you know, like how the music is done. And actually, it was a little bit tricky to record it on video because it turns out that none of the cameras go at quite exactly the right frame rate.
Oh, right.
So he actually, if I remember this right, even the camera that was supposed to record at 50 hertz actually recorded at 49.23 and drops a frame occasionally. So what he did was he wrote a new version that instead runs at 49.23 hertz.
Because of course he
just did. To record it.
Great. Yeah, and the audio is difficult to record on those musical drive stunts. Oh, there you go. He's showing how he built an enclosure with a microphone to record the audio. Because I remember that about the Commodore 64 music, the drive music demos. You had to put your ear like right up to the drive to hear it because it's very quiet. So that's clearly how he solved that problem.
Even with the soundproofing, it took multiple attempts to get a decent recording. Thanks, neighbor dog. So it's quite delightful. It delighted enough people that many, many people wrote to us about it. Thank you, Ian, Tony, and Tim.
This was all over Twitter, but I didn't click on it because I just thought it was another demo. But wow, this is a whole other level.
Yeah. And even if you don't like Commodore 64 stuff, this doesn't actually involve a Commodore 64.
Exactly.
Actually, my favorite part of the video is the beginning where he says, let's improve the setup by getting rid of the 64. I was like, you had me at throw at the 64.
Finally, the Commodore 64 drive is good for something.
That's right.
All right, we're done. Sorry.
Okay, yes. all right, so, and the next thing is Quint.
An article appeared on Vice recently, and I want to call out Vice a little bit on this one because Vice wrote a nice article on this guy, Brad Coda? Brad Coda, who is the guy who has this giant warehouse full of new old stock Atari parts. And it's kind of a good story. And I mean, Vice's write-up is pretty good. It's a pretty good, very high-level summary of this story of this guy, Brad, who was... at the time, around the Atari 8-bit era, he was a reseller of parts. And the TLDR is that as other resellers of parts and Atari themselves started to shut down, they were dumping all of their parts, and he bought everything he could find. So he bought whole warehouses full of spare parts to the point where now he's cornered the market. And then he sat on those parts for 10, 15 years. And now with the retro computing renaissance, he's suddenly like the kingpin of Atari parts. So he's got every single Atari console, every computer, everything. He has parts for all of them. And it turns out, don't ever give too much power to one person because this guy is kind of a jerk. And so now he's free to indulge all of the worst parts of his personality. And he's basically the soup Nazi from Seinfeld of Atari parts. If he doesn't like you, he bans you for life and you never get parts anymore and things like that. So there's literally stories of people getting their friends to buy parts and stuff because they've been banned. It's all quite silly. But I wanted to also call out Vice on this because they tried to get an interview with Brad Coda, and they could not. They made a point of saying how, you know, temperamental and impossible to talk to he is. And they also mentioned that the only two interviews he's ever done was for something way back in the day and some obscure podcast. And the podcast in question is Antic, the Atari 8-Bit podcast. And the interviewer in question was Randy Kindig, I believe. And yeah, they managed to secure the interview that Vice Media's professional reporter could not. And they didn't even link to the podcast. So in the show notes, I'll link to the Vice article. But more importantly, I have a link to the Antic Atari 8-Bit podcast where they did a full in-depth interview with Brad. And it's actually a much better listen than Vice's cheesy recap. So good on Antic for getting that difficult interview. And shame on Vice for recapping this story and mentioning the podcast, not by name, mind you, and not even linking to it. Boo Vice, yay Atari.
There's a twist.
It's funny though, when it was new, this did generate a fair amount of buzz, and a lot of the buzz that it generated, at least where I could see it, was like, I don't know what they're talking about. All of my experiences with this guy has been actually really good.
Yeah, I think they hammed it up a little bit here, because I mean, they do mention at the beginning that people have one of those two experiences: either he's great or he's a monster. So it's not clear which is more common of an experience.
Right.
But yeah, I think they did ham it up a little bit here. And, you know, this always happens whenever, you know, retro stuff hits the mainstream. It's always interesting to see how they twist the story and modify the facts and stuff. But it's at least a decent overview if you've never heard of this guy at all or don't know anything about this whole weird history of Atari spare parts. It's sort of interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I guess the next thing is Carrington's.
Retro is not necessarily as old as we want it to be. A lot of people think things from the 90s are retro. People born in 2000s can have their own retro, whatever. I'm old. I let you kids do what you want. But there was a game very popular for people in the 90s that us old people might not have heard of as much, called Drug Wars. Started as a DOS game and then got popular on calculators. It's all over the place. It was basically a trading game. Idea was, you know, buy low, sell high, but what you're buying and selling is things like cocaine and like, just, I don't know, drugs, whatever you kids are into, your jazz music and your drugs. So this is a neat article in Wired kind of looking at that, the long history of the game Drug Wars. The guy wrote it originally on DOS, and then the person who ported it to a TI calculator, and then its general popularity, the fact that you can still get versions of it today on Steam. There's Dope Wars Classic, a new version of it on Steam. Like, it's just a thing. So it's kind of interesting to see a retro, supposedly retro, you know, starting in 1991, retro game making the news. And it was two things to me. The first was, it was a reminder that, like, my own experience with retro is different than other people's. Like, you know, I'm older than that. So the 1990s, I'd moved on for this kind of thing. I'm not going to play this kind of game on a TI. But also it's neat how, like, I remember these same sorts of things and just like a different experience. That everyone seems to have those same super experiences. Like, oh, here's a game. Oh, this one's kind of like, isn't it neat? I'm playing this one because it mentions drugs. And, like, of course, on the Apple II, we had the same sort of things that's slightly dirty and how that suddenly makes it popular. So I thought it was a neat article, a good reminder that things outside of my experience are still valuable and interesting. And, you know, supposedly, we'll see if I keep that opinion, but it was a neat and fairly, for Wired anyway, a fairly comprehensive write-up on the history of this game. So if you were the kind of person who played this game, you're in classrooms and had your calculator, and instead of focusing on class, instead bought and sold meth on your TI calculator, then this might have some nostalgia value for you.
The only way I know about this game is that this is one of those games that, as you said, for people of a certain age, it had a strong nostalgia. And so it got remade a couple of times on more modern platforms. Like, I think there was like a homebrew NES version of it and that kind of thing. So like, those people, when they were 25, made retro remakes of it on newer platforms. That's the only reason I know about it, because people would talk about this Drug Wars thing that, oh, remember Drug Wars, OMG? And I'm like, no, I don't remember it. What are you talking about?
I remember Lemonade Stand. Is that similar?
Yeah. This was apparently a really big thing for a very narrow slice of people of a certain age.
So if you listen to our show, but you're like a decade or so younger than me, this article might be of interest to you.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Earlier today, I actually got an email from someone who had listened to Retrobits like 15 years ago and is still in the retro computing hobby, but started real young, like in the teen years with retro computing. And today, this gentleman collects workstations, among other things, some of the workstations from the 90s, like SGI, the HP PA RISC systems, Suns, and some of the newer DEC stuff. And I found it fascinating because for a lot of people, those mid-90s workstations wouldn't necessarily qualify as retro. But for some people, it definitely was retro. There are computers that they used in the 90s, and now, you know, today, 25 years later, they're something that they have some nostalgia for. And they go back and, you know, do things with them. And, I mean, there's discussion forums and websites and all kinds of things for that particular class of machines. It's just not something we cover very often, but definitely another, what would you say, another facet of the retro computing world, like a new generation.
Yeah, and I think workstations are a good target for retro collecting and stuff because they are a unique ecosystem. You know, it's hard to imagine me being nostalgic for, you know, late 90s beige PCs or whatever. But workstations, yeah, like they were interesting. Like every SGI was different and weird, and Sun workstations were different and weird. And, you know, they were cool aspects about them, much like the retro computers that we talk about, where what's interesting about them is how different they are and how they all solve the problems in different ways and so on. And I mean, SGIs were super cool. I mean, they were, you know, they were the Apple of the 90s in ways that Apple never was, basically. Yeah, so those machines are very, very interesting.
And, you know, you might not have been able to lay hands on one in the mid-90s because, like, for instance, the Indigo 2 that I had for a while, when it was brand new, I think it was more than $50,000
yep.
to buy one of those.
Yeah.
And then I got it years ago as part of a bunch of Unix workstations that I bought for $60 for, you know, the whole lot of them. So I would say that's some level of depreciation over the years. But it was a fascinating computer, though. Really cool.
Yeah, the most expensive computer I ever built was an Indigo 2. So I used to do IT at SGI in the 90s, and we would build demo machines for customers. Our client base was oil and gas, and they wanted like 3D visualization tools for geological data. And so we built a sample Indigo 2 with two Maximum Impact graphics cards. So it was a dual-headed, and it had two of those unbelievably heavy, I think they were 27-inch monitors, and they were just monstrously heavy. They were something like 90 or 100 pounds a piece. And they had that crazy video connector on them, the W13 or whatever that was like...
13W3.
Thank you. Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, it had the three coax pins embedded right in the connector. And yeah, I mean, that machine fully decked out, I think was MSRP on it was like $150,000. And yeah.
Well, the Maximum Impact was the top of the line for the Indigo 2 graphics
cards. Yeah, the graphics cards, yeah. Yeah, and the power supply technically wasn't spec'd for two of them. So the machine would run very hot and would occasionally shut down. So they never officially sold it in that configuration, but we would rig them up that way for customers and just not run it for more than 20 minutes or so. And heat the room up at the same time. And, you know, what's funny is that, the Maximum Impact was probably less capable than like a Voodoo 2 3D, you know, graphics accelerator for PCs. Like, but, you know, this was pre-3D accelerators for PCs. So at the time, that was the whole ballgame. Just the fact that it had hardware acceleration for 3D was untouchable.
The mentions of the Indigo workstation reminded me somewhat of this, which I just have to show. If you haven't been following NanoRaptor, Dana Subira, she's done some really just hilarious, you know, mock-ups of fake hardware. But this particular one is it's a Silicon Graphics Indian matching display, and it shows I think at some point we had a like an eBay auction that was like a briefcase of this factor, you know. So the machine itself has this weird sort of like diagonal offset top. I don't know if people can envision this, but
like it was in a really bad earthquake is kind of what they were going for.
So I see
the top of it is partially sheared off, kind of.
but the and the, so the art here is having a matching monitor, which also has that same kind of like diagonal shear in it.
It's pretty great. If we have any, speaking of retro gaming, as I keep doing, so the original Nintendo 64 development was done on those machines. So the mm-hmm. Nintendo 64 was developed by SGI, and it was originally the dev board, as opposed to being like later on they were a cartridge that you plugged into an N64 to download your code onto. But originally it was a special graphics card that you put in an Indie, and it had controller ports on the back of the graphics card. And so it was basically a Nintendo 64 in the Indie, and so you would just run your code directly on the machine. And yeah, it was a very, very expensive development environment to get set up with, because of course you needed a SGI to do it.
This, but it's definitely, if you have any sort of like a Mac nostalgia or whatever, this is a hilarious account to follow on Interopter, because basically it's just a lot of inventions of machines that never existed. Yep. Which, so what I've got on the screen now is a PowerBook Duo that is itself a Duo dock for another Duo.
The Russian nesting dolls of Duos.
The horrible thing, all the way though, down. Is that some of the designs on this Twitter feed, I actually look at and I go, gosh, I wish I had one of those.
Yeah.
I wish it was a real thing. There was one, wasn't there one recently that was a spark pad? It was like a, it had the form factor of one of the old Sun machines with the gray and the holes in it sort of thing, but it was in a touchpad format. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was, I wish that had been a thing.
And then, I wonder at what point people in the future will mistake these for actual things.
I was just going to say, because the Photoshop work on these is so good that, yeah, you have to know what you're looking at to know they're fake often.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the Macintosh ones that she does are just like some obscure configuration of Macintosh 2 or whatever that seems pretty plausible unless you know intimately the history of Macintosh of the 90s, and then you know why it's silly and funny, but otherwise it might be plausible to you.
Yeah. Somewhere there was also the like an L-shaped display.
Right.
Which was also looked pretty excellent. But yeah, okay, let's see. I think I might almost be there.
That Spark phone is excellent. I like that.
Here it is. The Apple Vision Display L.
That's great. It's portrait and landscape simultaneously.
The CRT engineering on this was a bear, from what I understand.
That's excellent.
All right. Anyway. Okay, let's see. I think my thing is next. And I was just going to mention that the Kansas Fest is coming up. As we record, it's 18 days away, and the schedule was just released. So that was just the thing that I was going to make my news item.
I'm very excited.
It looks really good. So, yeah, anyway, take a look at that. It's online again this year, so that's it. That's all I had to say about that.
I miss real life Kansas Fest, but I'm glad there's this in between.
Yeah, for sure. Looking forward to it.
Are you guys all going to be attending? Well, I know you will, Paul, because you have to by law, by court order.
That's right.
I will certainly be there. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm doing another Apple III thing, which any minute now I'm going to write, but
way too early.
Yeah,
I can't write anything for K-Fest the last 2 years because there's no plane involved.
Oh, right.
I do
exactly.
All of my That's... Apple II work on the plane.
Right. Oh, I was going to mention and didn't that in the chat, a couple of anonymous people have I will leave them anonymous just in case have said that they bought stuff from Brad, the Atari guy, in person, and he was idiosyncratic back then. So the last order a few months back, I asked to buy 5 things. He replied that his staff was too busy and I could only buy 3 things.
Which is funny if you know the story, because he doesn't have staff. It's literally a one person operation.
So anyway, okay. I guess end with that, a word from our sponsor.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and there in the house, the kitten discovered the new Commodore's mouse. Now touch the mouse to do what you choose. The mouse makes the Commodore simpler to use. Educate. Entertain. Put thoughts together. The world's best-selling family computer just got better. So bring home the new Commodore 64 now. A Commodore Christmas to all. and to all.
And we're back. And the retro computing gift idea this time is the floppy table. Carrington found this. I don't know how Carrington found this, and I don't actually know how much it costs.
Or because, why? Well, you it's custom made. It's a bespoke table, so you have to contact them to find out costing. It is shaped like a 3.5-inch floppy disk, but it's approximately 4 feet square, and it's made out of steel. Weighs a billion pounds and has a working slider in which you can stash a remote control. It's huge. It's like, it looks like something like the aesthetic is kind of like you would see it made out of plastic sold at IKEA, but you can imagine if this is actually just steel, how heavy this thing is. Yeah. Crazy. But got all the little details like showing here, the little embedded arrow and it's just, so if you want a 7,000 pound steel floppy disk cable and money is essentially no object to you, this floppytable.com can hook you up.
Yep.
Did we say the price?
No, the price isn't on there. You have to contact. If you have to ask, you cannot afford this item. It's one of those. Gotcha. It's one of those things. You know, yeah. Like you go in the stores that have it selling like clothing, and there's like three racks and eight items. It's one of those things. Like so, but yeah. Weirdly, of a floppy disk.
It's like how many dollars is it? Yes.
And it is not. It is not high density. I don't know if it's double-sided, but it only has one little hole spot. So don't flip it over. Disks have a hole on the other side too.
Brandon in the chat says the thickness is all wrong, and that is correct. It is thicker than it should be for its other dimensions. But it is a very large, very heavy steel table made to look like a floppy disk.
I wonder why they made it thicker. Maybe this person had a very tall remote.
I don't know. I wonder why it doesn't come with a label that is like, it could be a display. You could go crazy with this. But they, yeah. Like basically you talk to them and they're going to make it, and it's customizable to your own needs. So mm-hmm. The price needs. Is like, yes, set accordingly. Needs in quote, needs is doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
Yeah.
You're right about the thickness. It looks a little bit more like a jazz disc.
Yeah, it is off-putting a little bit. I think they probably did that to match the proportions of the legs better. Like the legs needed to be a certain size, so they designed the thickness to be what makes for a good table appearance rather than what actually looks like a floppy disk. It would have been sort of spindly looking probably, but yeah, it does make for a strange looking floppy disk.
And I'm sure it would, you know, it's probably very useful in that it will provide minutes of conversation.
Minutes. Exactly. And then you'll spend the rest of your life trying to dig dust out of those little arrow-shaped recesses in the little right protect tab.
Yeah.
It's the perfect table for people who either don't move or who hire movers. Don't make me your friend and think I'm going to move this for you for beer. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Does it say how big it is?
It's all the big.
Let's see. I think it does. Yeah. It is. It's measured in inches. So okay, it is 27.56 inches wide.
All right. So it's about 2.5 feet square. Yeah. That's going to be heavy. That's probably a 4-person job to carry that.
Very cool. Maybe next time we will provide something more affordable. But this time I think we provided something just sort of amusing. And when you've decided. You have all that money left since you didn't buy the table. You can go to eBay. Carrington has the first couple of these eBay auctions.
Oh, yes. Okay. The first one I think is gone. It's saying that it's out of stock now. And it's a relatively rare item. It's the PowerBook 2400C. So if you know your PowerBooks, there was a time where the sub notebook was for the Macintosh users. The hot one to get was the Duo, especially in areas like Japan and stuff where they really wanted a small notebook. And there was the 2300, and then that was replaced by the 2400C, but only in certain parts of the world. And its big deal was it was only 4.5 pounds, which was crazily light. You can imagine today it's crazily heavy. Here, just hold these two MacBook Airs. But it was 2400C, and it got canceled. It was 180 megahertz G3. It was canceled, and then in Japan only, Steve Jobs kind of, they say, made kind of a change and said, nobody wants our next thing, because I think it got replaced by the some other G3 that was like 8 pounds or something like that. Just like a massive jump up in weight. So just for the Japanese market, they made a 240 megahertz version of the 2400C, which is the 2400C is itself a very rare machine. And then the 240 megahertz version is the exceptionally rare version. So the Comet was the first one, and the Mighty Max, or the Mighty something, was the second one. And this is that machine. I don't think it actually came red, so this is a weirdly painted one, but it's not a machine that you see often. So it says here Comet in the picture, but this wouldn't be the Comet, because what makes this incredibly valuable is looking down here, that it's the 240 megahertz version. Now, that said, the motherboard on the 2400 was on a daughter card. So it was upgradable. So a lot of people get this and then upgrade them to, there was, I think, a 400 megahertz G3 upgrade that would heat it like crazy. but this version, it looks from the documents that came with it, was the one that shipped with the 240. So this is the very rare version of a very rare computer. And it was reflected in the price. I think the asking price was $3,500. And it's now saying out of stock, which I don't know if that means it sold or they just pulled it down or what have you, but you don't see this much on eBay, and it's gone since I first saw the thing.
I have never seen this before.
Another weird thing about this was it was made by IBM. So it's an Apple computer, but it was actually manufactured by IBM. So a whole bunch of weird things about this thing, and it only was around for like 8 months or so, and then had this Japanese only spin-off version. So exceptionally rare computer.
It doesn't actually look painted. I mean, it was painted really, really well.
Like, yeah. I don't know who did this finish, but I really don't think this came red, and it certainly didn't come with these things. There's no way they wouldn't have put Comet. That was the internal name for it. It did not come red.
Was this possibly a Japanese prototype or something? Because everything's all in Japanese.
Well, this version only came out in Japan.
Oh,
so
this
particular computer was the Japanese-only version that after the 2400C was discontinued, they brought back just this version, and then it got discontinued the next year. Everyone still clamored for this thing, and then like a year after that, the white iBook came out, and they went back into the sub-notebook class. So like really rare version of a really rare computer, and so doesn't come up on eBay much. But to see one in red was strange. So if you're into sub-notebooks from Apple that were actually designed and made by IBM, and you want only the obscure single country spin-off version, this is the option for you, except that it's gone.
It's got the keycaps are clear too, which is weird.
I think that's actually how those came, though. I think that is, I don't know. I don't know this version very much.
Yeah. But the other thing, too, about it being red is that it highlights much more than on the gray one, the fact that the trackpad looks like a mustache.
Yeah. Or devil horns or something.
Very good point.
But the interesting thing about this is if the red color is original factory, then this is insanely valuable. If it's not, if it was painted, then it's almost worthless. Like they've ruined the value of it by painting it. You know, they took some obscure, crazy, rare prototype and then painted it, which would be terrible. So, interesting.
So we either love or hate this.
Yeah.
I've never been a massive fan of this, but I know that some people, like, this is the grail computer for a lot of collectors. So the fact that it came up, I was like, oh, wow, it's the 240 version of the 2400C. Like, that is a very, very rare model. So I don't know if it went up and got taken back down because the person thinks they can sell it for 10 grand. I don't actually know what this go for, but I suspect it's quite a bit. So that was my first one. And then the second choice, really quick one, is I don't know this brand, but I've picked a Beehive International B100 computer terminal, and I love it for the logo. I think there's a picture of the logo. Right? Isn't that the most adorable, lovely logo? So it's a beehive with circling atom things over it. So if I ever got a terminal, I've now determined I would want a Beehive terminal, even though I don't want a terminal. And this one looks in rough shape, but I've just never heard of the brand before. I love that it's a Beehive. Do you guys know the Beehive brand?
I have one of these.
You, Earl, you have one of these?
Yeah, I have one of these because this is the terminal that MITS rebranded to go along with their business system. So I have this terminal, but sadly, if the logo is what you like about it, then you wouldn't like mine, because instead of the little beehive B100 there, there's a MITS logo instead. But it's the same exact terminal. It's the B100.
Interesting.
And it is giant.
Is it really?
You can't really see in this picture, but the depth of this thing is amazing.
Interesting.
Not being a person of much depth myself, I can't really judge these things.
Yeah, there's nothing in the photos for scale. It's really hard to tell.
I need a banana.
Yeah, throw a banana in there.
Yeah, it's just big. It barely fits on the storage shelf that I have in my storage room.
Oh, interesting. The company's from Salt Lake, so that would be why, because the beehive is the national or the state symbol or whatever of Utah.
Is it really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I only know that because I got a speeding ticket in Utah once, and their highway patrol logo is a beehive. It was actually a fix-it ticket, and I had to get it signed off by the RCMP when I got home, and they laughed, and they said, oh, you got a ticket from the beehive police, I see.
Well, this one has a buy it now of $1,000. So, Earl, if you want to trade up to a non-working version of the same thing you have, but a better logo.
Oh, I don't know if it's a $1,000 logo. I'm going to have to repair it. It's going to take some love.
Okay, I just love the beehive logo. So I picked this thing strictly because I think the logo is great.
Awesome.
It's funny. It does actually kind of look like, it's like it's from the 50s or something like that. When they made this, they were going for a nostalgic already at that time.
Yeah.
Kind of a logo.
Yeah, it looks like a prop from Fallout because it's got that 50s look and then the atomic logo on it. Like it looks it like totally satire does. Of the era.
I have to fight the Ooh. Atomic bees.
Can you scroll over back to the actual screen itself?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
oh,
see, my screen has that same thing going on.
What is that?
I'm not sure.
It's blotchy?
It's that CRT issue where the safety layer of the CRT, over time, the glue degrades.
Oh.
And
it
for
starts
chumps.
To get this kind of obscurity on it. And if you want to repair it, it's really, really tough. You have to there's no clear-cut way to repair it, because any way that you use, like if you remove the safety glass, then I guess it's not glass. I think it's a substrate of plastic. If you remove it, then you're kind of removing the safety aspect of it, which it was intended to protect you if the CRT imploded. So it wouldn't, spray glass on you.
Oh,
so
interesting.
Removing it is a little controversial, because if you do that, then maybe it's not as safe to use. But if you don't do it, then it's got this kind of gloss, sort of cloudy look to it. So it's fairly common with some of those old terminals and old CRT displays.
Interesting.
Quinn, I don't know if you noticed in the chat, Brandon making a comment on you getting the RCMP to fix the ticket, that the horsey police are making jokes about the beehive logo.
Yeah. Maybe there's no heroes in this story.
That's it. That's what I got. I don't suggest buying either of the things I picked. They caught my eye.
Excellent. Okay. Early, you have the next auctions.
I just have one thing. I picked this because I was curious if you guys had ever heard of it. For one thing, it is a little less common for people to collect productivity apps from the DOS days. So I thought that was interesting. This looked like it was even new in box, if I remember right. Have you guys ever heard of Multimate?
Sounds familiar.
It sounds like a name that they would have, someone would have chosen for software.
Right. maybe that's why it's familiar to me too.
Yeah. It sounds like a very DOS productivity software name.
It is. And this was in the 80s at Hughes Aircraft, where I worked at the time in the IT department. This was our standard word processor, not word perfect, as you might expect. But we had this. And as I understand it, the reason why we use this is because it was very similar to the way the Wong Laboratory's word processors worked. So if you were familiar with doing word processing on those, it wouldn't be much of a lift for you to come over and use Multimate. Now, I guess that was an advantage for people who knew that particular technology, but what it left us with was a word processor that was just pretty quirky in terms of the function keys and the commands that you would use to get it to do things. You know, if you knew the Wang word processors, then you were probably in great shape. But for the rest of us, we had to learn a really weird way of doing word processing. Not that WordPerfect was hugely better with their, you know, control Alt F7 kind of thing. But I was just curious if you guys had ever bumped into this in your travels. I use this a ton.
Not seen this.
Strangely avant-garde photos along with the thing. Like there's a zoomed in corner of the cover of the manual and like bits of some of the pages. It's very weird choices.
Yeah. And some of them kind of like 90 degrees. So it's actually kind of hard to read them. And there's a kind of, sort of a highlighted, there's a sticker on it this is an upgrade. So in fact, actually, I wonder if you need to have the original version in order to use this, but the upgrade sticker warns you that you're supposed to destroy all the documentation and diskettes of the upgraded product, including backup copies and updates.
That seems
harsh. So be sure you do that. If you buy this, be sure you do that.
Better comply. So, there was Multimate International, and those actually came in like a blue, as I recall, like some off shade of blue sort of slipcover.
So this was Multimate Domestic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then Ashton Tate purchased them.
Oh, I see.
So then if you look at the front cover of this, it does have a very Ashton Tate DBase 4 era sort of look to it, mm-hmm. which I didn't really like their choices of styling in that particular era. But anyway, I was just curious if you guys had bumped into this. And the price wasn't very high. The price seemed reasonable.
Yeah, it starts at 35, yeah.
Weirdly, as we're discussing this, I feel like I might have lingering nostalgia for WordPerfect because I spent quite a bit of time in that on my dad's PC with the keyboard overlay so that you could remember that Control-Alt-F6 was bold or whatever. And I had the screen layout of it is etched in my brain. Like, I still remember the margin indicators and everything all rendered in ASCII. Maybe I'm a closet PC productivity software collector.
Maybe.
Yeah, I do. Sometimes I feel bad for productivity software. You know, it's like no one really wanted it that much in the day, but even now,
was
you know,
boring
this,
then.
Yeah,
boring now.
I mean, yeah. You know, what a quick in 98. You know, who's going to want that or TurboTax? You know,
I don't know. I have fondness for some old, like Quinn, like there's some word processors that I loved at the time. I wouldn't collect them now, I think. But like when I was using MacWrite, I was a MacWrite user, man. I loved it. Nicest Writer 2, Claris Writer, like a bunch of them. Mm-hmm.
Claris Works, I adored on the 2GS. Claris Works on the 2GS was incredible piece of software. Really, really good.
All right. Let's see. So I'll move on to some of mine. I have... In celebration of the day, I have a fourth cartridge, very rare, hard to find, fourth cartridge for the Commodore 64. That's all. I don't know a thing about this. Is this, Earl, do you know anything about this? Is this, you know?
I haven't bumped into this particular one.
Okay. So
there were several fourths for the Commodore 64. Most of the ones I'm familiar with were on disk as opposed to a cartridge.
Were any of them called Commodore 64th? Because if not, I feel that was a missed branding opportunity.
Yeah. Very nice. Oh, why didn't somebody do that?
Very sad. Actually, when we were kind of fishing around for topics, another thing that I was thinking about was screensavers, because, you know, fireworks and that sort of thing.
I would have things to say about that. We should do a show on screensavers. I would have stuff to say.
I should. Yeah.
But I loved After Dark. So cool.
Yeah. So I have an auction here for After Dark. This is version 1 for Windows. It's got all the packaging and stuff like that. And I don't know if it actually. I'm not sure if version 1 actually had fireworks. So maybe this was not all that pertinent for the day. But anyway, it's After Dark. It's kind of iconic.
After Dark is sort of fascinating to me because it was like this. They built this software empire around something that could only have existed in this very narrow space of time. Like, they managed to convince people that that screensavers were premium software, and they charged premium prices, and they had you know, expansion packs. And it was this whole ecosystem that existed. There was an SDK and everything for this product that was only dubiously necessary at the time and is definitely not necessary now. But wow, they really like leveraged that moment, I guess, in time.
Yeah. One of the things that they have in this box is a thing, you know, like an After Dark t-shirt you can get. only $10.95 plus $3 shipping. And the idea, I guess, is that it's cool enough and in fact, actually, on 90210, the night club, I think was, I think it was called something like After Dark, Peach Pit After Dark, I think that's what it was. And it had actually like a Flying Toaster logo, you know, I mean, like it was in the culture.
Yeah.
It was, as Carrington would say, the zeitgeist.
I would say that.
You would say that, yeah.
I'd probably misspell it, though.
Somewhere I have a tile from the Peach Pit somewhere. Like, anyway, whatever. In some box somewhere, I have a tile from the original Peach Pit set.
That's random.
But, yeah, anyway. Not retro computing related, but I know my 90210. let's see. What else? Well, yeah, this is just another thing. Actually, it's Amiga related, and we'll hear more Amiga related stuff.
Ooh, maybe something for Quinn.
In the world of video output, this is a little device that basically it goes in an Amiga 500. It provides you with HDMI output. The way it does it is you plug it into. I'm not sure actually what the chip is that it replaces, but you plug it into the board in for a chip, and you put the chip in the socket that's on there, and you put a Raspberry Pi Zero on there that produces the HDMI output. But it's, you know, it's a pretty simple little thing. If you provide the Raspberry Pi Zero and have a working Amiga 500, this will work. Yeah.
So it's another one of those, put a more powerful computer inside this computer and it'll give you this one extra feature.
Yeah, that is
not bad. Like a $5 computer.
Yeah,
I've been seeing a lot of buzz about this, videos and all kinds of things. This is getting a lot of traction, it seems like.
Well, I mean, it's $27. I mean, like it's really quite cheap for what it is you're managing to do here. So, and of course, it's what this is an adapter for the most part, you know, and the Raspberry Pi Zero is the thing doing the video, but.
I always, cool. With these things, I always wonder about latency, though, like, especially like using a Raspberry Pi to generate the video. So, I mean, that Raspberry Pi is like running Linux and like converting video, like there has to be a bunch of lag introduced by that. So I wonder, like, are games playable? Do demos work properly? Like, I'm sure it can generate a static image properly, but is it really usable for gaming and stuff? I always wonder. I don't know.
I think that it's a bare metal Pi application.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
That's doing this.
Well, that would help. Okay.
That's what I would guess that they would want to do that, at least to try to avoid any sort of underlying processes running and randomly introducing.
To hopefully
time.
Minimize the lag. Yeah. Interesting.
So the other thing, I have a couple of these, and is a General Magic Data Rover 840. This came across my feed, and I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. By the way, it's the 4th of July, and it seems like the birds are getting anxious outside. So if
the birds are celebrating
bird noises
freedom,
make it through. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, this is
Is it eagles? Are all the birds eagles?
I'm sure today they are. Yeah.
Today every bird is an eagle.
So I never did get around to watching the General Magic documentary. I've always meant to, and maybe I still will. But it's General Magic was this company that was, it was basically, I think, ex-Apple employees went and made their own PDA company, and they created this operating system called Magic Cap. There were a couple of different producers of Magic Cap devices, but this. Is the latest of them. It is, I think, the only one that General Magic itself actually put out. And it is like version 3 of the operating system. And there's a review of it that says that this is what General Magic should have been doing basically all along. And it's the Magic Cap device that should have been you know, rather than the lower powered one that they put out first. But anyway, so this was basically like the end of the line best of the Magic Cap devices. There's actually a really pretty interesting kind of like write up on, oddly, on Microsoft.com. The Buxton collection is something that is hosted on Microsoft.com, and there's a write up of a bunch of things, and one of them is the Data Rover 840. So it sort of talks a little bit about the environment and stuff like that. It's got sort of like a desktop metaphor. I mean, like with actual little like pictures of phones and Rolodexes and stuff.
That's a little on the nose for a desktop metaphor there.
Yeah. But anyway, it's an interesting device. It seemed to me like this wasn't very much for it. It's a $70 buy it now. But then I saw another one, which is also for $70 starting bid, or $91 buy it now. So maybe this is actually the going rate. Anyway, I thought it's sort of an interesting device. And it turns out, actually, I have mine here. But I don't have the appropriate battery or power connector, so... I was going to try to turn it on and see if mine looked like those pictures, but that's a project for later.
I do like the name of that company. It's like General Motors, Magic. General Electric, General Magic.
Yeah. Actually, one other thing, I don't know if you can see it here. Yeah, you probably can. So it's a sort of a, I don't know how big it is, maybe like 3 by 4 by 6 inches maybe or something like that. It's kind of big for a PDA. And it's got a little slot for like two, what do you call them? Two cards.
PCI cards.
Yeah.
PCMCIA.
Yeah. And it has it actually has a little spot for a telephone connector that flips out and you plug it in and has a backlight. And it has a bus connection. The name of the bus connection is the Magic Bus.
Oh goodness.
That's pretty wonderful, yeah. So that, I think, even by itself, that was enough to make me want this. it looks like it's kind of a nice device, and it's not super expensive if you're curious about it. And if you've seen the documentary, you probably will want this more, I'm guessing. So,
where is that documentary? Just like on YouTube? Or?
That is a good question. I'll find a link for it. GeneralMagicTheMovie.com, apparently. We'll have a link to it, and maybe by next time I will have watched it. I've heard good things about it, though. Okay, let's see. Is it worth talking about anything else? I think maybe there's one more thing I will talk about, because I don't know much about this, but maybe others here do. This is a Blue SCSI SD SCSI emulator for vintage Apple Mac specifically. This is the same kind of thing that the SCSI to SD performs, and it's about the same price range. Maybe it's a little cheaper. This is a $55 thing. This is maybe a little cheaper. And I don't know to what extent you would want, like, why you would want to pick one over the other. I think Joe's Computer Museum, Joe Strohsnyder, did a video comparing these. He compared this and SCSI to SD version 5 and version 6 and then a spinning drive. And I don't remember what he concluded. Well, and I think, you know, the spinning drive actually did pretty really well, except for seeking. It kind of blew the other ones away in terms of like actual throughput, weirdly. But anyway, so if you're looking for yet another SCSI solution, this seems to be a relatively cheap one, particularly if you're trying to get it to work on a Mac. So,
yeah, I mean, the throughput is always going to be limited by the SD card. I mean, they're serial, mm-hmm. right? So it's mm-hmm. like sticking a 1541 interface on your hard drive, basically. That's always been the problem with flash memory, except for compact flash. Like, the death of compact flash was sad because it was by far the fastest mm-hmm. in parallel.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think I'll leave it there. And Quinn, you have the next auctions.
Yeah. So the first one is the Commodore Amiga A3400. And this was a development system for the Amiga 4000, neither of which were apparently released. So if you were interested in developing Amiga software, then you got the Amiga A3400 sent to you, and then when the Amiga 4000 was released, you would know that your software would work on it. This was something that was fairly common back in the day with new computer models. So this is apparently a prototype, apparently obscenely rare. This was a link that Blake sent around to us, and I don't know how I became the Amiga spokesperson on this podcast. I'm the least qualified person to talk about this, but these two items were so good that we had to not miss them this week. So, yeah, this thing is pretty amazing. I mean, if you're an Amiga collector, it's hard to imagine finding a more rare and interesting device than this, because, as I say, the Amiga 4000 was never even released, and then here's the development system that was itself never given apparently to any developers, and then for a computer that was never released. This is just the prototype of a prototype. Like, this is, you know, rarest of the rare. I wouldn't be surprised if there's only one or two of these in existence. So pretty amazing. And this person certainly has priced it to reflect that. The starting bid on this is 10,000 British pounds, which is about 13,000 US dollars. So yeah, bring your checkbook for this one, kids. I can't imagine they're going to get any kind of serious offers at that price. But this is certainly a pretty cool item to look at.
How do you combine the words checkbook and kids? The kids are wondering what the heck a checkbook is.
Yeah. What's a checkbook? Yeah, I don't know. It's retro finances for retro computing, I guess. The kids are waving their Apple Pay at this, trying to get it to take their 10,000 British pounds.
Yeah, it is, it's located in rare. Hamburg, Germany. And would cost an additional $540 to ship to me, but I guess when you're talking about that many, it hardly matters.
Yeah. And there must be a story here too, because apparently the motherboard says A3630 on it, which there's a little bit of story in the description, but I sort of feel like there's a lot of unanswered questions about what this thing really is. Pretty interesting device.
Mm-hmm.
Gotta wonder how people end up with this stuff.
She says suspiciously.
All right, so on to the next item then. And this one I like because I have a little bit of a personal connection to it. So this is the Amiga 1060 PCXT sidecar. It's built as a PC emulator for the Amiga. But of course, there's undoubtedly just a PCXT in it that is being talked to. So this is sort of the PC transporter for Apple of the Amiga world, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it's a neat thing. You don't see them come up very often. Blake was saying about once a year, maybe one of these comes up. They're pretty rare. They want $315 Australian dollars for it, about $230 US, which sounds like a pretty fair price for how rare they are. It's kind of yellowed, but otherwise seems to be in decent shape, although it does say not working, so I don't know what that means, but I guess it is pretty dirty, but I don't know. The chips are all there, so it's probably possible to make it work. Yeah, this one stuck out to me though because we all had that Amiga friend back in the day and wouldn't shut up about the Amiga.
Wouldn't stop talking about it.
Yeah, so I had one of those.
They were the CrossFit of computer users.
Exactly. Yes, the CrossFit of computers. So in my high school electronics class, one of my favorite classes, I had my token Amiga friend. And him and his brother were diehard Amiga people, and they had one of these. And so he was very excited to tell me all about this thing when they one day at school when they got this thing. And he bragged at the time about they ran a Mac emulator on it. And he said he claimed that the Mac emulator running on the PCXT sidecar on their Amiga was faster than an actual Mac. I am sure that is not true. I doubt that such an emulator even existed, but you know how kids make up stories, especially at that age. And so he was, yeah, very excited to tell me all about that. But so I thought that was funny. I'd never actually seen this device that he was talking about, or, you know, he was a bit of a storyteller, so I often wondered if it even existed. But here it is. It was in fact a real device.
And he's selling it online.
Yeah, this might be it. Right. He was a good guy. If he's listening, I enjoyed our talks in electronics class. But this was a bit of a tall tale, I suspect. But it's a neat box. It's got the hard drive in it and the power supply. It's basically a full-on PCXT in a pretty small box that would plug into your Amiga. So I don't know if you have to plug in an external floppy drive or if it, you know, how it does with interfacing with the Amiga, you know, if you can move files back and forth, I'm not sure, but it's a pretty cool thing.
There are a couple of pictures of ports on the side and on the back.
Yeah, but, those look like serial ports, I guess.
Yeah, and then there's weird ribbons hanging out.
I think it's assembled poorly, but I assume the ribbon cable goes to the Amiga. I guess, yeah, the more we look at the pictures, it's not in great shape, to be honest. Who knows if it works or what? It's had a hard life, it looks like.
That one's actually been bid up to $315 Australian dollars. So,
yeah, okay. So even for...
Apparently it is interesting.
Yeah, even for one people. In this rough a shape, people want it. So that speaks to its rarity, I suppose.
Yeah. Herb in the chat was asking whether, maybe the hard drive is the problem. I was thinking that too. As soon as I saw the hard drive, I was thinking that maybe the reason it's listed as not working is because the hard drive crapped out.
Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like you could buy this and not worry about getting it working because, I mean, XTs were simple beasts. Like either the power supply died or the hard drive did. Both of those are easily replaced. So I'm sure the BIOS and the CPU in it are fine. So, there's nothing else really to go wrong besides the power supply and the hard drive. So, I'm sure you could get it working just fine.
Yeah. Well, if you buy it, let us know how it went.
And send us screenshots of you playing Ultima 6 in CGA on your Amiga.
Right.
Or running a Mac.
Right, doing some speed tests.
Yes, I want to see someone running a Mac emulator on it. And I actually want to know, are there any Mac emulators for the XT? That seems too early to me for emulation of any sort. I don't know.
Yeah. There definitely are for the Amiga. I mean, like, you could get a little add-on thing that would run Mac software.
Ah, okay.
I mean, basically, you just put the Mac ROMs in it, and that was the main thing. But all right. We made it through the eBay auctions. So now I guess we can go to closing thoughts. Any thoughts anyone had? Carrington, you are first. And you wrote something in the notes.
Am I? What did I write in the notes? Oh, puny-informed sexism. Yes, I got I made a complaint online about puny-informed, and I convinced all the dude bros that I'm a men's rights activist. I think people misunderstood my complaint completely. Oh my God. I've been really enjoying puny-informed, working on a text adventure game, and I'm, here and there, and it's taking forever, as all things do. And I only recently ran into what I consider a fundamental flaw in this language. It's really just chafing at me enough that I might want to fork it. With inform, you can specify an animated object as having a gender, and you get three choices: neuter, male, or female. Those are your three choices. Puny inform, I guess to save space or whatever, they've stripped it down. You can only assign neuter or female because male is just assumed, always put in, that's the way it's going to be, you should just use that. I'm like, what the heck, man? And I guess I just had not created any male characters in my game yet. And I made the first one. I'm just like, and I'm trying to assign male, and it won't let you. Like, it's fine for it to have an assumption. It's an odd choice of assumption. I mean, come on, man, don't be a gatekeeper. But the fact that you can't assign male, it's like, no, that's just assumed. Why would you ever need that word? It's just been upsetting me so much that I now am putting it in comments in my code. I'm just like, bang, animate has male. I'm like, no. And it's bugging me enough that I may actually fork puny inform it's bothering me. It's bothering me so much. And it's bothering me so much that the people who made this language clearly didn't see that this would be a problem. And it's just annoying me.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it wasn't an oversight. It was sort of, it was intentionally done.
Oh, it's called out that it's like when I look through the documentation, it's called out. It's like, oh, no, there's no reason to have that. Why would we even have that as a thing? Because, of course, that's just assumed. Just if you want to, for some reason, do something other than a dude, then I guess we'll let you. What? And the fact that you can't assign male, that it's such a forced assumption, they won't even have that word in the language, is just, I've been upset about it for like a week and a half. So anyway, that's what's going on in my retro life. So I'm going to fork a language.
Is it open source? Can you open a pull request to fix that?
It's on GitHub. And I'm like, okay, great. So come on, man. I'm going to break everybody else's. I'm going to assign a new change, and I'm going to break everybody's software. So,
is it puny inform or is it?
Yeah, just puny inform. Inform 6, of course, has all three. Puny inform, I guess, to save space, it will just make a male assumed, but also just force it all the time, and we won't even use the word male because why would you need that? It's just because, of course, everything's male. Male all the time. So
it's not a Z machine thing.
No. Nope. It's just in this specific version.
I was just curious if it had something to do with the particular implementation of the Z Machine interpreter, or
it's clearly to save the byte or whatever. And they said, well, the one we'll skip is that. And I'm like, the tone deafness of that is annoying. But the fact that I then complained about it on Twitter and not having enough words on Twitter to kind of explain what I meant, and a whole bunch of people were sending me like DMs saying, yeah, like, why should you have to, like, it's just they're all think I'm like, they think my problem is the exact opposite of what my problem is. Oh, I'm like, my problem is with how my code looks sexist now. My problem isn't the fact that, like, women are trying to get into code, darn them. Like, oh, God. So, anyway. See?
Fun.
Still upset. I'm still very upset about this. Like, how can you make a language in 2000 and X and make this choice? I have no idea. Crazy. Crazy. So there's gatekeeping going on in Puniform land, and I'm going to change it. So that's it.
Excellent. Sort of.
Yes.
All right. Earl, did you have any? And actually, there's a question from the chat too. I don't know if you saw it, but the Brandon in the chat wonders what happened to all your S100 machines. I don't know if that was part of your closing thoughts or not. But
oh, I still have them. They're just the Altairs, and yep, I've still got them. And in fact, I think I'm taking a couple days off here along with the 4th of July, so I may drag another one out that I haven't refurbished yet and kind of take it apart and clean it up and start to see if I can figure out what's going on with it, because it's one of the ones that has all the LEDs and the switches, and when you turn it on, all the LEDs come on, and it has no response to any switch settings that you do, so I'm not sure what's going on. So I'm going to have to do a little bit of a deep dive into that. But on the closing remarks though, I was going to say, so a long time ago when I was in university, back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, we had a class called Programming Languages, and it was a survey of a variety of languages just to give you a very, it was like a mile wide and an inch deep sort of survey to let you see where, what strengths and weaknesses the different languages had, and give you some exposure to things. One of the languages that we studied was called Snowball. It has nothing to do with COBOL, even though it rhymes. And it had to do with string processing. It was very strong in that particular. And I really enjoyed learning just this tiny amount about it, and then didn't touch it again for like decades. But I was chatting with Randy, and we were talking about topics upcoming for Next Without Four, and it turns out he had the same thing, the exact same thing happened to him, that he had that just, very brief exposure to Snowball and then nothing after that. So I went looking to see what's out there today, and it turns out there's a modern implementation of it that you can use, and there's a site with a whole bunch of resources. So that's one of the things I'm going to be looking into is Snowball 4 and kind of reviving some old, old brain cells.
And is it Snowball, like, spelled like COBOL?
Yeah.
Yeah, all capital letters. I think it stands for String-Oriented Symbolic Language, which doesn't really work with that acronym. And so it's
that's
kind of messed up.
But it's string.
Oh God.
Yeah, they tortured that to get it into a word that looks like COBOL. Yeah.
Yes.
But okay.
Which is ironic because it has absolutely nothing to do with COBOL. Doesn't look at all like COBOL.
Yeah.
But we got it. You know.
It really does seem like a joke.
All capital letters. That was the rage back then, and these were the days when Fortran was in all caps, and we loved it. So the other thing I was doing is learning some 8080 and Z80 machine language, which is really interesting because I'd only ever been a 6502 person. And in the 80s, it was the 6502 and Z80 ultimate bake-off with all the different micros that came out, right? And a lot of people were Z80 or Z80, if you're not in the States. And I didn't know much about the processor. I'm learning about it now. I'm like, wow, this is fascinating. This is a whole different approach. It's got lots of registers. It's got lots of commands, especially the Z80. It's got just a ton of different things it can do. But still, head-to-head performance-wise, it seems like the 6502 and the Z80 were pretty close competitors. And I think, from what I've read, that owes to that the 6502 It almost like, I guess you could make the metaphor of RISC versus CISC, like the 6502 had less stuff, but the stuff that it could do, it did in less cycles, could do more efficiently. So that's why you saw things coming out with in both camps.
Yeah.
It's just really fun. And I'm really having a fun time learning about it. And also, this is a weird thing, but you know, the 8080 and the Z80, as closely related as they are, they have completely different mnemonics. And in a lot of cases, different mnemonics will do the same thing. And I think it's because the team that left Intel to do Zilog and do the Z80 couldn't use the Intel mnemonics. So they had to come up with their own set of mnemonics, which when I look at the two, I actually like the Z80 mnemonics better than the 8080. But okay, I've talked enough about that. Anyway, I'm just having fun learning about that stuff. I'm kind of seeing how the other half lives, because I was never really a 8080 or a Z80 guy, and now I'm learning what was going on that side of the tracks.
Yeah, it's not, I mean, it's not just an analogy. The Z80 was the OG CISC chip, and the 6502 was the OG RISC chip. Like those schools of thought and processor design go back a lot further than a lot of people realize, and it really was intentionally designed that way in each case. And the Z80 is a great chip. It's actually a better chip than the 6502 for homebrew computer building, because the Z80 is a static core, which means it holds its state when you stop the clock, which the 6502 does not. Mm. And so you can have, you know, it's much easier to single step through memory and things when you're first bringing the computer up. And I think that's a lot of the reason why there are so many more Z80 computers back in the day than there were 6502s. I think it was probably also cheaper, but it's a much easier core to get up and running than the 6502 is. The 6502 is hard to get it to do things at first because it has fussy timing. It's got the two-phase clock, and you have to keep the clock running, and you know, it's a little fussy at first, but the Z80 is much simpler. So yeah, it's a neat chip. Definitely.
It's fun learning about. I'm holding up something now. This is called a Z80, or I guess since this is from the UK, I should say Z80 Playground. Mm-hmm. And this is a what I think started out as a homebrew project, but then the gentleman who was making them decided to sell kits or fully assembled models. And this is just a small little single board computer that can run CPM or run other Z80 things off of a USB thumb drive. And it's super fun. So this is a cool little board to experiment on and try things with. And even the EEPROM here, it is in a ZIF socket. So if you want to burn your own EEPROM and pop those in and out, you can do that without bending the pins.
That is cool. Yeah, that's a great additional point for making homebrew computers is that if you make it on, if you base it on the Z80, you get an operating system for free. Like you can run CPM on it when you're done. Whereas the machine that I built around the 6502, no operating system for it. So, you know, you got to write that yourself too, after you're done building the computer, which is a whole other can of worms. So, that's a really cool feature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Z80 was also super popular for arcade machines too.
Yeah. A lot of arcade machines and game consoles and things that used it. Yeah, and it was
NTI calculators.
Yeah, that's right. Uh-huh. And it had a very long life in embedded systems as well, like cars and refrigerators and washing machines and stuff. There's probably still embedded applications out there running on Z80 cores.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've been hoping I could try to get into a little bit with the like coprocessor cards, and like so the Apple II had a very popular CPM card that had a Z80 on it. And I have the card and I've never once attempted to program it, but it would be, but it is, it's an interesting kind of exercise to not only learn how to program the thing, but also like learn how it interacts as a, you know, within a larger host, you know, so it does things like take over the clock. And I don't think you can run the 6502 and the Z80 at the same time doing things in this situation. I think one sort of takes over the RAM or whatever, whichever one's running. But anyway, I'm hoping I will get a chance to play with that. I'm looking forward to it. I know that one thing that makes me think that they're, you know, like the Z80 is more complicated than the 6502 is that I always think of them as running at a higher clock rate. So like the Z80 is always going, Z80 is always going at like, you know, 3 megahertz, 4 megahertz or whatever. And yet it's not going, you know, it does not perceivably faster.
Yeah, it is. It's, and you see that again, that's that CISC RISC thing. You see that all the way into the modern era, right? Where, you know, PCs were running at, you know, running at gigahertz, and they were at the same speed as, you know, power PCs or RISC chips running at 2/3 of the clock speed. And it goes back to what Earl was saying, that the RISC efficiency means that they don't need as much clock speed. Whereas, you know, the CISC chips are using 50 clock cycles to do an add or a divide or whatever. So they need 50 more megahertz sort of thing to do the same amount of work in the same amount of time.
All right. Let's see. I think I'm next. I don't have much to say. Maybe I'll... I need to write my Kansas Fest talk. So, and edit. Once again, I've gotten behind, so we're recording this before the one before it came out, but any minute now that'll be fixed, all of these things. Quinn, any closing thoughts?
Nope, just looking forward to Kansas Fest, and I also kind of want to look up Snowball now. I never wrote anything in it, but I do remember that language, and I do sort of love that languages never die. Like, I'm constantly amazed every time we talk about one on this show and we go and look it up, and oh yeah, there's still people using it, you know, like whether it's Logo or whatever, there's always some new modern version of it that was written last month that people still use, which is crazy to me. So yeah, I kind of want to go and look up all these old dead languages now and see which ones have modern implementations. But yeah, that's cool.
Something
stuff.
To keep in mind if you're ever going to write your own language too, that if you write exactly. it, once you bring it into existence, it will never die.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, there's so many modern languages. I mean, Go and Haskell and all the rest. You can't even keep track of them all. But yeah, that's neat. So yeah, that's going to be it for me on my update. Not much.
All right. Well, we made it. Only right around the 2-hour mark. That's pretty good for us.
There's a question for Carrington though.
Oh,
whatever happened with his G4 iMac?
Oh, yeah.
It's right there on the desk beside me.
Ah, okay. Not in shot.
Still here, still loving it, still playing with it. I think I told everybody I had upgraded the stuff in it, upgraded the RAM, changed the hard drive to a solid state one. That makes a massive difference in boot time. It's great. Mm-hmm. Wasn't actually that difficult to open it up and make changes. I'd heard horror stories. Wasn't actually that hard.
Okay. What mouse do you have connected?
I do not have – I have sitting beside it when I'm not using it for aesthetics, the clear mouse that came with it, that okay. useless clear piece of garbage. But I just use a Logitech mouse with it when I'm actually using it because I'm not a monster. Like, come on.
Is that the hockey puck mouse, the round one?
No, not that
it's
bad.
It's an oval.
Oh, okay.
I can bring it over because it's not plugged in, this one.
Oh, that one. Oh, I'd forgotten about that one.
It's clear. It's pretty. It's useless. It's so slow, it barely picks up anything. It's like you don't realize how good mouse lasers are now compared to 2000 year mouse lasers.
The old roller mice, yeah. Like the cheapest, crappiest $3 mouse you can buy on Amazon is 100 times better than like a 2GS mouse or a 90s PC mouse.
Yeah.
And this has these little things on the side that look like buttons. You think they're buttons.
Yeah.
These are not buttons. I don't know what they're there for. They're there to make me think.
I remember it's those. A button. It is a button, but you have to squeeze both of them together. It was like a shortcut thing. Yeah.
I swear it does nothing. I'll plug it back
in. My 660 AV mouse had that. Maybe it's not supported on the version of macOS you have or something, but yeah, it was a thing that you have to squeeze them together.
Because I'm using only macOS 9. I don't use the 10 on it, because why would I be using it?
Yeah, I don't know
day.
When they introduced that, but my 660 AV was running Mac OS 7 though, and it had that. You had to squeeze them quite hard, and it was basically useless because it was so.
This is Quinn's way of saying that I'm too weak to use a mouse. Nice, nice. Yeah. I like how you worked that in there.
Either that or it's some kind of elaborate prank.
An excuse to bring up the 660 AV, which is a good reason to bring it up because that was amazing.
Yeah, no, it was a thing. You had to squeeze them together and quite hard. It was the dumbest thing ever. Like, it's not convenient. It's not ergonomic. It didn't respond well. And all it was like a hotkey that you could tie to something in the desktop. But it was a terrible idea. I don't know what they were thinking.
I'll break my little hand. My little weak hand can't handle that mouse.
Well, I got my the A2, what is it? A2IO thing.
Oh, cool.
The little Bluetooth, you know, whatever it is, connector for the wireless controllers. I have not tried it yet, but I have it.
Nice. Of course, Torrance did a review of it also on his YouTube channel. I think we mentioned that last week when I talked about that device. Right. But
in case anyone's interested. Great. Everybody should subscribe to his channel.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I like his stuff.
Okay. Anyway, I think I was just congratulating us on how quickly we got done. And then
we talked for 10 more minutes.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm going to just jump in and say that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com.
It's my favorite part of the show. No, wait, the whole show to try to make you break.
Not very hard, because see, I'm usually kind of weary at this point. You can please write a review on iTunes. That will help people find the show, perhaps. And until next time,
Retro-compute.
There we go.
Where pretty girls can fall from the sky.